Hello, folks. So I've been getting a few email correspondents that have been asking me about the question regarding open source and decentralized and ethical communications. How do we get our friends and family on board? And I think this is, quite frankly, one of the biggest frontiers that free software has to face. It's one that's constantly under threat. It's one where the corporate actors are the most insidious, and I also think that it's one of the most important. It's a heck of a mountain to climb, but I think this is where free software needs to make some gains. We can look at like the Linux-based operating systems as an example of how free software has done something wonderful and great. So great, in fact, that many corporations are actually using the code and the resources that we've pooled. And whilst I don't necessarily think highly of operating systems like Chrome OS or even Android, I do recognize that they wouldn't have been built on top of Linux if Linux wasn't incredibly wasn't good, you know. Now, actually saying that, I'm, you know, Android in and of itself is not a bad operating system. It's just so online centric, so Google centric, and efforts to de-Google the Android operating system, I think, do offer up a pretty good operating system, all things considered. So, my problem with Android is the Google politics of it all. So, where has free software had? And when I say free software, so we look at the Linux-based operating system, and it's great, right? If you have a laptop or you have a desktop, the chances are it could probably run Linux pretty well. People who want to use free software can use free software. I've put people in my life who are not necessarily technically adept onto Linux, and they've had zero problems whatsoever. If you're wondering what distribution I choose for them, it's usually Linux Mint, and Linux Mint works great. I think Linux Mint has some good defaults. I think the Cinnamon desktop's great. I think the XFCE desktop is also quite good for lower end machines. It works well with printers, or as well as any other Linux distribution works with printers. In fact, to be honest, so many Linux distributions do struggle with printers that, you know, the Ubuntu based ones work the best, and Linux Mint is Ubuntu based, but it strips out a lot of the Ubuntu stuff that I'm less fond of, like snaps. Snaps are opt-in on Linux Mint, for example. I wish that Flatpaks were opt-in, but I understand that if they want something with a long-term support base, they probably want something with some newer software on top of that. But it'd be nice if there was, even if it was just a selection in the Mint App Store, just to be like, yeah, I'd like the Flatpak repository. It's fine. Just click that. And then maybe in that same store, they could select snaps as well. As long as it's opt-in, then that's all good. But that aside, I think that free software, for the most part, I mean, you can look at something like Linux Mint, and it's not an entirely free software. Some of the drivers used will have proprietary components. There are going to be some media codecs included that are not necessarily free software. They talk about this quite a lot in Linux Mint circles, and they don't want to deprive people of common functionality. It'll just put people off Linux. People who have a stronger adherence to free software philosophy will take it upon themselves to learn how to use distributions like GNUSense, Parabola, PureOS, for example. They will be more freedom respecting. But this is for people who are going very deep down the rabbit hole. For most people, they just want to break away from the dependence of corporations and the dependence from the big tech. Most Linux distributions will be pretty capable of that. Sometimes I worry a little bit when it comes to the likes of Canonical, whether or not they're just trying to be Microsoft, but they're less successful at the capitalist side of things. And I see this particularly when, not just necessarily with snaps. Snaps in and of themselves are a useful technology for allowing proprietary tools to be ported to Linux in an easy and reliable way, and there are people that would make use of this, right? However, it's when they start embedding it into parts of their system where you get snaps that are installed as part of your machine out of the box. When you go to install a package from the distribution repository and it pulls in a snap as almost like it was a dependency, that I don't like. You know, snaps should be opt-in. They shouldn't be an integral part of the system. And the reason for that is simply because snaps are a centralized repository. It's basically a proprietary operating system at that point. And we don't need another we're on Linux to sort of get away from that. We understand that at times we have to make compromises, but the fewer compromises, the better. We'd like to keep as much of our integrity intact as possible. We don't want to roll back to corporations or the corporate way of doing things, because it fundamentally treats us like a herd of cattle or a flock of sheep. But anyway, I think that the frontier of the operating system is in a good place, right? We're in a place where we can at least survive, where the free software movement, the open source movement, we can carve out a sizable space of millions of users and be safe here and be able to do what we want. I can do everything on my Linux machine I could ever do with Windows. I can run the thousands of games that I want to play. Tens of thousands of games. I can run any software that I need. I can do any task that I need. In some areas, it might not necessarily be the best in the world. It might not have the best audio software or the best video editing software, for example. But it's good enough for 99% of cases. And in the event that you are such a person that requires such advanced software, such specialized software, there's a good chance that you might be earning enough money as part of your day job as an audio engineer or as a video editor that you can afford a separate machine anyway. And if you can't afford it, then you're probably, you may be a hobbyist or getting on the ladder or whatever. I've used plenty of free and open source software for very professional, high profile tasks. And I think in a lot of cases, a lot of people just aren't willing to learn how to use open source and free software to the fullest potential of it. I've designed billboards with Scribus. I've designed big street banners with Inkscape. I've designed corporate logo, or not even corporate, organization logos with Inkscape that have been every bit as good as something that you could do in a proprietary piece of software. And in a lot of cases, especially in the design world, simple designs are what you need, right? Overly complex designs are a nightmare to work with because when you're working with design, you need your designs to be versatile. And that's why so many designs tend trend towards minimalism and simplicity, because that gives them versatility. So it's not like you need complex tools. And in a lot of cases, complex tools are something that's sold upon you. But also, you got to be careful that tools don't take away your autonomy. I was talking with Hex earlier today. If you were in a car and you drove yourself from A to B, you would consider yourself doing that, right? You operated a machine to get you from A to B. If you did that in a self-driving car, did you still drive yourself from A to B, or were you driven to from A to B? Where does the talent in that equation lie? Does it lie in you, the ability to purchase and sit in a self-driving car? Or does it lie with the countless engineers that have actually developed that software, tested that software, integrated that software? That's not to say that constructing a manual car doesn't have that same level of talent. Of course, vehicle engineers are incredibly intelligent people and wonderful at their job. I love driving my car. I love my car. It's reliable. It's sensible. It's great. It's a very small car, very small engine, but it's a faithful tool of mine. But that being said, there comes a point when you're no longer the one using a tool to complete a task, when you're just telling it to do a task and it's basically doing itself. There may be a time in the future where video editors become so good that you just throw some footage at it and it'll splice it into a way that is most appealing to most people, that has, that auto sets the audio levels. It will even pick out the right kind of music that will suit with the piece of that music. It could all be AI generated. Are you even still a video editor if every single facet of that task is taken care of the editing task in particular, is taken care of by the program itself, right? The more the program does for you, the less the talent, the less it's your work, right? So I've always had an affinity for basic tools. Even when I do woodworking, I, for the most part, stay away from power tools because I think they separate you from what you're trying to craft. If you're doing it for a job, if you're professional, that's a whole different kettle of fish because you're on company time or you're on the customer's time. Best job for the money, the best job in the quickest time for the money, it's a simple equation. And that it arguably is one of my key problems with capitalism, is that it basically reduces so much of our society to the equation of making more things cheaper, faster. When really, I think we lose a bit of our soul in the process. So, but I think for the most part, the tools on Linux are great. The Linux operating system is great. This is an area where free software, I would say, is successful. We can get more people across, but at the end of the day, the battle is not with the technology. It is with marketing. We are dealing a battle of psychological warfare against people who have a lot more money and information and tools at their disposal than we do. But we can hold our own, and I think that's enough. We can do more, but we're in a position, we are in a defensible position. And there are other areas where free software has done particularly well. I think open standards are particularly useful. Open document standards, open codecs, all of this kind of stuff. The OGG format, I'm a big fan of. It'd be great to push this. However, of course, the big opposition to this is Apple. Now, Apple are often touted as especially the iPhone is touted as a slightly more privacy-centric device than an Android device, because its profit motive is in delivering a device to the consumer rather than collecting your data and using it to advertise you like the Google brand. Honestly, I think when it comes to a lot of the devices, Google just want you in their ecosystem because you're easier to corral and control. Same thing with Apple, all things considered. But Apple devices, iOS, they are pretty horrendous when it comes to like indie software, right? Free software, smaller development studios, all this kind of stuff, right? If you have an iPhone and you want to use it for Discord, WhatsApp, Zoom, you're fine with an iPhone. You want to use it to browse the kind of stuff that you'd get on the F-Droid store? You are shit out of luck. If it's not big and corporate, Apple are less likely to support it. And on the side of codec, right, this is what gets me about Apple. Right? I had a good old chuckle about this, right? Apple, allegedly, they sell themselves as the best operating system, the best set of hardware, the best at multimedia. Yet they are the sole operating system that do not support free and open source codecs, that do not support OGG. You have to download a special, you know, you have to download VLC on the iOS or anything like that in order to play a free and open source piece of software. And I believe the reason is because Apple have a lot of money in the proprietary codec market. So Apple, by only supporting, by being the de facto multimedia operating system, but only supporting codecs that they have a financial stake in, means that non-Apple users or producers of software that are used on non-Apple devices have to then pay software license for codecs to Apple, or in part to Apple, so that they can then support certain file types, because Apple do have their foot in the in that particular camp of intellectual property. So Apple are making money off non-Apple users because they are peddling this myth that their operating systems are the best at multimedia stuff, when completely when all things said and done, the same software you can get running on Mac runs on Windows anyway. It's ridiculous. It's a con. It's literally a con, which is why I will never, never, never trust Apple. Right, because they sell themselves, and let's not even forget the basic slave labor which their electronics are created under. Not saying that that doesn't happen in other facets of the tech industry, it sure as hell does. But the fact that they get people to use that single stack of hardware and do it in unethical ways is a little bit more abhorrent than at least having choice of software. You can pick the least evil option when you've got an open operating system like Windows or Linux, right? I know Windows isn't great, but at the end of the day, when it comes to Windows versus Mac, 10 out of 10 times, I would choose Windows, right? It's got its problems. Oh boy, does it have its problems. But at least it's not as locked down as Apple. And Apple sell themselves as a lie. And I think that's horrendous, if I'm completely honest. So I do not trust Apple at all. It's taken me a while to actually get to my point, but regarding free software movement, we've had some great successes. We've even had some successes in the political world with things like Right to Repair. And that's great. But when it comes to communities, when it comes to connecting with people, this to me, I think, is the most important battle. Because at the moment, the greatest enemy to the... We often talk about freedom of speech in the free software world, and that is important, right? I believe that it is important for the health of democracies to be able to speak freely about ideas in particular, right? Also to freely challenge ideas, right? Like the freedom of speech does not mean the freedom for people to then speak back at you. And you know. But I think we often forget like really other important freedoms, like the freedom of assembly, the freedom to associate with people that we wish to associate with. And I think the greatest threat to this is Facebook. And I think it's squarely Facebook. I think others perhaps have a hand in this, but I think Facebook are a genuine threat to the freedom of developing our own communities and developing our own friendship groups. Because Facebook take a lot of information. They take a lot of people hostage. If you're not on Facebook, you have no business. If you're not on Facebook, you cannot access so much of the so much of the world's communities, right? You're going to be locked out of local groups. You're going to be, you know, there are so many people whose only presence on the internet is like through Facebook. In many ways, that's a problem on us people as a whole for allowing Facebook to do that. But for Facebook being such a centralized, corporatized, privatized town square, I find to be absolutely abhorrent. And as I say, there are other companies that do it as well as Facebook, but Facebook have done it to the most damaging degree. They fundamentally make a business model out of holding people hostage, right? If you do not submit yourself to the entire Facebook ecosystem, which requires a heck of a lot of information from you, you are cut off from communities. And some of those communities are going to be people you know in real life as well. Most other social networks do not require the amount of information on yourself that Facebook does. And I think that's deeply harmful. It's also harmful that Facebook have an entire litany of incredibly unethical practices, including, but certainly not limited to, running psychological experiments on their user base to manipulate their mood, taking advantage of anorexic teenagers, losing millions upon millions of records. So all this data that they ask, it's not even kept responsibly. It's ridiculous, and it has a tremendously harmful effect on our society. It truly does. The free software answer to this is the better answer. It's open protocols. So we're not talking about a siloed service like Signal, which is open source, but also relies on incredibly proprietary and corporatized infrastructure. But open protocols, it gives the end user meaningful choice, right? XMPP, even IRC, which is somewhat centralized, but still like a common protocol. And I suppose Matrix. Matrix is still young, it's still in development, but at least it's decentralized and open source. I'd like to see more Matrix clients and servers, and I'd like to see the efforts decentralized outside of the whole Matrix organization. I've seen some clients that are made by even people I know, actually, some wonderful coders I know have contributed to code that has created Matrix clients that are actually pretty good clients, all things considered. So it's getting there, but I think Matrix is very much new. And I'd like to see how that turns out. But we do have existing protocols that are lighter, and they require fewer resources, and they're quite easy to get your head around, right? We have, XMPP, which is a great instant messaging platform that you can actually use from a choice of places. I use Snopitar. Snopitar are really good, and I've even asked around and asked some of the folks that run the services there, and they said that XMPP is very light on resources, and that makes it accessible to more people who host as well. IRC I think is great. IRC has its roots predating the 70s or something, but IRC as we know it I think was invented around 1988. That's right, I said 1988. 88. That's 33 years ago at time of recording. About that. That's pretty remarkable. Now IRC is somewhat centralized in so far that you want to talk on a particular server. You can often be expected to sign up to that server, but not always. I think with IRC, if providing a nickname has not been registered, you can just put in a burner nickname, and it's all well and good, as like a temporary nickname. And that's all well and good for the most part, unless there's a reason your identity needs to be particularly verified. And identities are somewhat verified in to one degree or another. It'll take a look at your IP address and it'll determine, well, is this running through a VPN, or is this likely to be running through a VPN, or is it likely to be a domestic IP address and all that kind of thing. So some servers will have different criteria for who they allow to connect based on the information available to them, but they ain't asking for your driving license. They ain't asking for photo ID. They ain't asking for your phone number or anything like that. And that's fine. And you can have private IRC servers as well, but the common protocol allows a choice in back-end software, front-end software, all that kind of stuff. It gives end users the freedom, and the freedom to operate as they see fit as well. I think XMPP is great. It's genuinely decentralized. IRC is very much centralized on Freenode. XMPP has loads of different servers, and they all interlink pretty seamlessly. I've had very few problems with IRC. Those of you are probably likely to ask me what my IRC server is, my client is. I use Conversations on the mobile. There are other choices, some of which are based on Conversations. I use Gajim or Dino, depending on basically how I feel. Gajim's pretty good. It has a kind of, it's slightly dated feel, but that's not bad. Like, it's good. And Dino's a bit more modern, but not quite as full featured as Gajim. So it depends what I need. Also, there is a web client that I often use if I'm feeling I'm going to quickly check what it is, actually. Converse. And that is actually included as part of my Snoppetart address. So there are even web clients, so you can just log onto a website. What I wish to see out of XMPP is a better way of making it look and function more like, your WhatsApps and your Telegrams, something of a more expected paradigm. And there are groups that are trying to do this. There's one called Snicket, which is, certainly, I think it's still in development, but you download like the Snicket app, and it can connect to a Snicket server, and it runs quite seamlessly through that. There's Conversations, where they also include the ability to sign up to Conversations. I think that costs something like €8 a year, about that, which I think is a fine price for XMPP. And you can sign up using that through their app, I believe. There's also MoveIm. I've not tried MoveIm, but it looks pretty good. I should give that a go one day. And a lot of these seem to be like a lot of the way there. So that's quite good in that regard. But I don't know, how close we are there yet to just being able to say it's not even necessarily about the technical adeptness of the average end user. Most of your end users are capable of understanding how XMPP works with a very simple and short conversation. I think the problem is knowing where to sign up, knowing who you can talk to, finding other people to talk to, and all of that kind of stuff. Like a lot, you can't just say to someone, "Oh, use XMPP." And they'll go away and work it out. Like that's I think where things like XMPP can fall down a little bit. Hopefully you should be saying, "Oh, just use MoveIm. Just go to, just use the MoveIm app." And that might get them on the, here's my address. Catch me on the MoveIm app, or catch me on Snicket, or catch me on something like that. Catch me on Conversations. In the same way that Mastodon is known as a part of the Fediverse. It's like, I'm on Mastodon. I mean, really what they're saying is I'm on the Fediverse, but Mastodon is the app, it's that corner of it, that's fine, right? We're all interconnected, so it doesn't matter. But I often will say, use the terms Mastodon and Fediverse interchangeably. Same thing with PeerTube and Fediverse. I'm in the Fediverse, it's all the same place, it's all interconnected. And that's all good as well. I think the Fediverse is actually a really good example of open source, an uncompromising open source collective working really, really, really well. And I think the Fediverse is well on its way to claiming a social space away from the corporations. And I think the Fediverse as well is particularly good because it uses, you know, the activity pub protocol, which I think is really good. And it allows so many things to connect into it. You can convert RSS feeds to ActivityPub, which plug into Mastodon, all that kind of stuff. Oh, Mastodon and the Fediverse and all the components of the Fediverse are a shining example of this. And I think this is an area where free software is making meaningful leaps and bounds in social spaces. And I think we should be pushing the Fediverse. We have great tools at our disposal, but I think XMPP need to work on they've got the technical stuff down wonderful, and IRC as well, right? I think the growth for XMPP and IRC is to have them as like really just user-friendly spaces. If you're on Mastodon, you can just be like, I'm on Mastodon, join me on Mastodon. Someone can work out a Mastodon instance to join and get on there pretty quickly. Mastodon is not complicated. Just go get mastodon.org. There'll be Mastodon apps, a choice of Mastodon apps, and it's great. So I think that natural growth of the Fediverse is, and don't get me wrong, it doesn't always grow. It contracts and it grows. It contracts and it grows. Many people are finding the feed-based social networking to be problematic to their mental health and their well-being, and that is valid and that is justified. But for those of us that that are more comfortable in that world, I think we should push the Fediverse, right? It has direct messaging. It has a way of contact. You guys can and do contact me through the Fediverse, through Mastodon, through Plerima, through MissKey, and that's great. It's wonderful, and I love hearing your messages from it. It's not private and secure and end-to-end encrypted or encrypted at all in that regard. There is some degree of privacy, but I'd rather call that discretion than privacy. But for most, you know, social conversations, just chilling out and hanging out and having fun and all that kind of stuff, building the relationships in those social spaces, that doesn't need to be completely private, right? It's similar to like having a chat down the pub with your mates or having a meal in a restaurant and talking over the, you know, business of the day, that kind of thing. It's not a private place. It's just a chill, casual place where people can just be out in the open and be themselves and express themselves. And I love that the Fediverse as well has moved on from so many other social networks. It doesn't talk about itself. That's the great thing about it, right? Most social networks fail before they reach that point. Most social networks end up just talking about themselves, talking about themselves, talking about themselves, and never end up talking about anything else, because in a lot of cases, that's the thing that everyone on that platform has in common, that they're interested about this new social network. Not just open, that doesn't even apply to open source social networks. It just applies to just new social networks in general. If you can get past that wall, things tend to look quite promising. The Fediverse has been around in one shape or another for like over 10 years. So it's not new. Mastodon is a lot newer. I would say that's 4 years old now at this point, perhaps. And it's had its ups and downs, its highs and lows, but at the end of the day, I still am on it and I'm still having a good time. Again, not for everyone, but I think it's an example of a social space that free software has claimed and done a great job at it. So we've had some successes in this space. And I think if we want to bring on people that are not necessarily part of the free software movement, but we want to free them from the corporate shackles, I think the Fediverse is the soft target area. It's the area where we can demonstrate that we have character and personality, where we can distinguish our differences from the corporate world, and where communities have the autonomy to build themselves. There are board game Mastodon instances. There are artists Mastodon instances. There are free software Mastodon instances. There are general Mastodon instances. There is a Mastodon instance where you are not allowed to use the letter E. And that is a remarkable instance. It's a really good instance as well. It's because my username on it is Chris Was. And you see, you get it, play on words. And what's interesting about it is that it actually makes you think about what you're typing. You don't just fly off a status in the heat of the moment, because that will almost certainly have the letter E in it. You are forced to read and think and reread and rethink every status you post. And the posts are of a much more thoughtful quality as a result of that incredibly arbitrary stopgap. And it's a remarkable social experiment. It's alippo.social. If you want to find out, catch me on the Fediverse and I'll point you in the right direction if you're still interested in it. But it's remarkable. But there are all kinds of instances. Some of them are local. There's one for Wales, toot.wales, and I post pictures, photographs that I take up there. And and I've only got a couple of Mastodon instances, a couple of accounts across the Fediverse. But my main one being Chris Ware at linuxrocks.online. But it's fun. Like, I'm there enjoying myself. I'm not there to even push the free software agenda. I'm there because it's a free software space, sure. And I feel like it's free from the shackles of big tech. But at the end of the day, most of what I post is just other stuff that I'm doing. I very rarely ever talk about the meta of the Fediverse. And I think that's and the same goes for many other people. I talk to people about cycling and gardening and painting pictures and all this kind of stuff. Like, it's great. And free software should be that. Free software shouldn't always be about itself. We're not going to be more accessible to more people if we only ever talk about, really techie stuff. The humanity of free software is in and of itself a meaningful selling point. And I think sometimes that's often overlooked in spite of the, it's often overlooked because of the interest in the technical side of things. Both, of course, are incredibly important. We shouldn't and couldn't have one without the other. I'm, of course, much more interested in the humanity side of things and how free and open source software can actually improve the lives of as many people as possible and improve the world in general by having better built systems, because the human race is built on systems. But there also need to be people who develop and maintain and build and improve these systems. We need people of all different types of talent in order to make the free software movement as strong as possible. In fact, I firmly believe that anyone that cares about free software, regardless of their technical ability, has something meaningful they can contribute. Heck, if you just post like the dankest memes on the Fediverse, you're doing a service. If you're like really good at skateboarding and you post really cool skateboarding tricks on the Fediverse, you're doing a service to the free software world. Literally anyone of any talent can be a contributing factor to developing social spaces outside of the corporate structure. And that's important. Free software at its heart should be inclusive. Sometimes it's not, and that's a problem, and we should try and fix it. Because if we're not helping the world, then I don't think we're reaching our potential. So that's just my two cents on it there. I think it's easy to build a better world for yourself, but I think it's important that we don't become so insular that that's all we do. And I think that what's the point in developing all this wonderful technology that gives us freedom and autonomy and ownership over our digital lives if we can't share it and use it to free others? So I've talked a little bit about, the importance of open standards, right? And I think this is also kind of important as well, right? So I've talked about codecs and that kind of stuff. And that is important, right? Because it allows people to use different types of software. Sometimes they might choose to use proprietary software, but if it produces a file like a vector graphics file, for example, then that can also be used on other vector graphics software like Inkscape. So open file formats, I think, are definitely a frontier that free software by and large wins at. And that's great. I think it's a good example of allowing end user freedom while at the same time preserving the integrity of free and open source software, because it gives people the choice. It allows people to take steps into the free software world knowing that if they don't like what they see, they can easily take a step back. We're not locking anyone in, unlike a lot of other actors in this in this situation. So I can talk a little bit about Session. You can get Session is an instant messenger, which I believe works on the blockchain. I'm not entirely certain how it works. It's not an open protocol. Fundamentally, it's an app that you download, you put either on your phone or your desktop computer. It provides you with an ID code. You give that code to other people and they can communicate with you. Now, whilst it doesn't seem to operate from a central server that I'm aware of, and that it is about as decentralized as you can hope, it's still centralized in terms of you need to use the Session app. It's probably more comfortable to the end user. You can just say, get Session. You don't even need to sign up for anything. Give me your ID when you get it, and then we can chat. I think it has its place, but I don't think it is a way to genuinely systemically solve the problem, because it feels ephemeral and temporary, but also I think largely useful, similar to Tox. When you use Tox, T-O-X, you can use a variety of Tox clients. They will then generate a string for you. You give that string to someone else, and then you can chat directly peer-to-peer. And that, I think, works quite well. That can drain battery quite a lot on mobile phones, as I believe Matrix can, because it's quite complex in that regard. But yeah, peer-to-peer communications like that, because you're making those direct connections yourself, you are effectively acting as your own server. It can be quite a drain on a mobile phone's battery. Less of an issue on desktop in that regard. But yeah, I think that when it comes to that kind of stuff, I think it can be quite accessible to the end user. But at the same time, particularly with Session, the software itself comes from a centralized source, right? Like, it's, you know, changes they make to the software are ultimately something that the end user has to deal with. Whereas, like, with a common protocol like XMPP or IRC, the end user has the choice. There's, you know, between dealing with a change or using a different client or using a different server. Like, so many of the components along the chain can be switched out. And I think that is a strength of the free software movement and digital autonomy in the broader sense. Okay, so it's well over 30 minutes into this audio clip, and I still haven't really meaningfully addressed comprehensively the questions that I've been asked about onboarding friends and family to free software communication. Now, this is kind of tricky. I'm not necessarily suggesting you or get all your friends and family, least of all family, to be honest, on the Fediverse. The Fediverse is a raw and untamed place, and I love it because of that, but it's a social network in so far as the other social networks have their own character, the Fediverse has its own character. It's not going to be suitable for everyone. And different parts of it are going to be suitable for different people. So use your discretion and be cautious in that regard, but the Fediverse is a fun place, and I do feel that we can onboard a lot of non-free software types into that world, and free them from the shackles of the corporate corralling. But when it comes to instant messaging, a type of social network that a lot of people feel is less toxic, presumably because there's a lot more control over the nature of it. Small WhatsApp groups amongst friends are unlikely to cause you unnecessary drama in your life. You're understanding each other within a more personal context, and I feel that that's important, because I don't think human beings are wired to communicate with thousands of people at a time. And you can put any text up, and if enough people see it, some people will dangerously misinterpret it. I think that many people, I hope, can, you know, give people some degree of the benefit of the doubt. Sometimes people just say horrendous stuff, and that's bad. But I think sometimes people say something which is not necessarily controversial within the context of which they understand it, but because we all interpret the world through our own lenses and our own cultures, that it can cause some degree of problems. This is a much more complex issue than I'm willing to give the time for it right here, so don't take any statement that I'm making as definitive or anything like that. I'm just trying to say that It's certainly not a communication medium that everyone is going to healthily engage with. But when you've got smaller groups of like, you know, WhatsApp groups, Discord servers, Telegram groups, smaller groups where people come together, they communicate, it's not the kind of social net, you know, the social networks that aren't about getting lots of followers and building up an audience, but rather ones where you just have a small number of friends that you can have ongoing meaningful conversations with. This is the space I really want to see free software move into. So this is the XMPP space. This is the Matrix space. Matrix is a great piece of software, but it is also quite resource intensive and also quite complex and also could be quite janky. I'm going to say something that I think is going to be disagreed with from some of you. I don't think Matrix should necessarily or automatically come with end-to-end encryption. I think that there are better ways of doing it, and I think that it scares off a lot of users having to verify various devices that they want to communicate as. I think it makes things difficult, and I think for the most part, if you just want a room to chill out and hang with the friends with, and you have to do a whole bunch of security and privacy backflips, I think people are going to be turned off and they'd rather use Discord. I think this is a big design flaw in Matrix, making the encryption as janky and difficult as it is. And not all of the apps are great, but some apps are coming along now that are actually really good. So I think that there's definitely progress in the area, but the end-to-end encryption stuff, I think, is actually a big turnoff. And I think that it's more important to get people away from Facebook than into something that's perfect. We can't let the great be the enemy of the good. And I think the primary objective is to get people away from the corporate channels and get them on ethically hosted places, preferably self-hosted places or communities hosting themselves to maximize the degree of freedom and autonomy, and allow people to set their own boundaries, set their own rules, set their own, you know, like a lot of this is about consent. It's about what people consent to and to whom they consent with. With the centralized services like Facebook, you do not have a meaningful choice in how to consent. You're either part of their infrastructure or you're not, and that is what disturbs me. Yes, freedom and privacy are important, but for those people that need it, there are channels, existing channels that work really quite well for people that seek it out. What I'm looking for is bringing your friends and family along for social spaces that are nothing serious, just you know, what you would otherwise talk about on Facebook and all that kind of stuff. We don't necessarily need the level of privacy is not necessarily a problem that a lot of people are looking to solve, and even the level of security. If you're just talking about, you know, planning a day out with the family or planning a trip with friends, it's not something that necessarily needs to be encrypted. I know there are arguments against what I'm saying, but I think that we should prioritize getting people out of the corporate sphere rather than encrypting every single jot of communication that we have and that we send. There are definitely spaces where that should be, and yes, it's better to encrypt everything in an ideal world, but when it gets to a point where people start having trouble with it, and then people start leaving the platform. So I think that is something we need to bear in mind. I think XMPP does this rather quite well. I think Matrix could do it better, if I'm completely honest, but I hope to see this change in the future. Maybe some clients will start putting in a more user-friendly approach to this, but all things considered, I would like to see Matrix take off a little bit. I actually have a Matrix room. You can get to it who, what, where, on the Matrix channel. I'm looking to see if I might move that room away from the main matrix.org server to somewhere else, and I'll have a little bit of a look around to see if there are some other options for me, just to, you know, not overly centralize it, and possibly have it on a place where if something goes wrong, I have someone to talk to. It doesn't seem like when you've got, you know, a platform the size of Matrix, if something goes wrong, I think you generally sort of have to deal with it. And that's the problem with big centralized communications, is that the support is very weak. And if something doesn't work for you, then you're on your own. So I think that Matrix and XMPP, they are areas I'd like to see more user-friendly solutions there. I also think that text messaging is not bad in that regard. It's not free, it's not open source, but it is decentralized. If I do not like my phone company, I can choose another provider and keep the same number. I can still connect with people. I can switch out. Yeah, I could. I do have some degree of autonomy there. SMS text messaging is not encrypted, so again, it falls into the casual day-to-day use bit of, you know, planning a trip with the friends or whatever. It's better than WhatsApp, which is, you know, having to deal with everything handed down from the grace of Facebook, whereas with SMS, you have a little bit of control, you have a little bit of choice. It's not your infrastructure you're communicating on, but you are paying for it, and that is a meaningful difference there as well. I have seen a resurgence in email lately. Now, of course, you folks know that I like to get comments sent through on email. I think email is a great protocol, and most people are already on email. Email has stood the test of time. It's still relevant and useful, and part of the reason it is relevant and useful is because no one company owns email. That is incredibly important, and I don't just mean that from a philosophical and ethical point of view, but functionally as well. There are, you know, business reasons and such that and definitely pragmatic and practical reasons why a company may wish to own and host its own methods of communication, or not use Google, for example, not use Microsoft. It's having choice over the software and communication that you use through the common medium of email is important. It allows someone who lives with an entirely different set of tools, or a set of online tools, to communicate with someone else. Email is the most universal way of communicating digitally online. And I think we can work with this. I do communicate with a lot of people through email. I know people who are not technical who also do the same thing. I've organized a lot of things through email. The fact that email is not as fast-paced and it favors, in many cases, the long-form content is also great. It allows people to give some thought to what they're writing. It allows people to post paragraphs and paragraphs and paragraphs of information without it necessarily being spammy or disruptive or anything like that. That's great. Email is great on a whole host of levels, and I think we should all be trying to use it more. But wait, there's more. There is an app I've seen getting a slight resurgence as of late through the Fediverse called Delta Chat. You can get to this through, I believe, delta.chat. I'm just going to double check that there. Delta.chat. There we go. It's available on Linux through Flathub. That's the Flatpak. A Debian file for a Debian and Ubuntu. App image, and the AUR. You can also pick up the source code itself. You can also download it on Google Play for Android, FDroid for Android, and the Amazon App Store for Android. You can also just download the APK. You can even get it on iPhone and iPad through the App Store. You can get it on Mac OS, through the Mac App Store, through a DMG file, or with Homebrew. And you can get it on Windows through the Microsoft Store or download their executable file. So what I really like about Delta Chat is that they've truly gone out of their way to make sure that their client is available on as many platforms as possible. But what is Delta Chat, you may ask? It's an email client. It's an email client. But it's more than just an email client. It turns email into instant messaging. It provides a user interface similar to WhatsApp, similar to Telegram, but it just sends and receives email. And it can even do end-to-end encryption as well. It's free and open source, and like I said, it's available on just about any platform under the sun. Further to that, you do not need the Delta Chat app to make use of, to communicate with someone who does. It is just an email client. So you're already communicating to a wide network of people that can already receive your messages and can reply to you. You don't have to convince anyone to use the app, but if they are interested, you can just direct them to delta.chat, and they'll know how to do the rest from there. They'll be directed. The instructions are great there. There's even a nice FAQ page. It's wonderful. I think this is a direction that a lot of people should be investigating. Maybe some people might just want to use Delta Chat or even one of the many other great email apps on their phone, but I think Delta Chat's really good. You can even use it on the desktop. You can customize it quite a bit in terms of the emails that actually you receive through the Delta Chat app. Now, it is to some degree expected that that's not your only way of interfacing with your email, that you may open up your email client from time to time to use email in a more usual way. But if you're just firing off a few emails to friends saying, yeah, that's great, see you at the pub at 8 o'clock, you can just fire a message off in Delta Chat. And then you can do all your more important correspondence at home on your desktop machine using your regular email client. You use the same account. Now, I don't think necessarily having to sign up for a new account is something that turns people off, because, you know, it's something that people are quite used to now, and my Bitwarden has accounts for hundreds of various different services. But the freedom to decide not to use Delta Chat but still be able to engage in, you know, communication is great. To be part of that same social network is great. Yeah, I think Delta Chat is a really useful tool, and I think email is really good. I think that we should, where possible and where sensible, use email as a way to communicate with people. It's an open standard. There is so much choice for the end user because of that. We can use our own email clients of choice. And everyone's on it. It's great. So I think that there are some wins that free software have had in the building of communities online in communications. We've got a lot of choices and a lot of prospects. The battle isn't fundamentally a technological one at this stage. XMPP works really well for the overwhelming majority of cases when it comes to building communities, replacing things like WhatsApp, whatever. Delta Chat works basically just as well. And that, again, uses common underlying protocols, email. The battle is really now making these appealing to use. This is a difficult one because we are in a constant psychological war with corporations seeking to exploit people. This is where the meaningful parts of the revolution have to be fought, because other places don't necessarily depend on the end user being held captive the way that they try and do with the likes of Facebook and other media as well. With the Fediverse, for example, the antithesis to a lot of the big social networks like Facebook, like Twitter, like Instagram, is that if you don't like engaging with something on Mastodon, you can use Plarima or Miskey. Or you know what? You can even use an RSS reader. The end user has the ultimate choice. But all Mastodon accounts have an RSS feed. I think Plarima does too, and I assume Miskey does as well. I know that PixelFed does and PeerTube does. There are also ways that you can just subscribe through ActivityPub as well. The end user has the choice. That's great. So I think that we do need to find ways to make these appealing and useful. If we have a hand in developing and setting up communities, I think we should try and do them on free and open source software using open protocols. When it comes to friends and family, I think text messaging and email are probably the best first steps. And I think this is something that I'm going to have to look into a little bit further and to ask the non-technical people in my life. Usually the non-technical people in my life, I use email and text messaging, and that's generally pretty fine. Sometimes a phone call. That's a little bit old-fashioned now, and maybe I'm an old-fashioned kind of guy, and maybe this is you know, I'm thinking in old-fashioned ways, and maybe I need to update that. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on it through the Fediverse, through email. But I must admit, many of you have noticed that I've been making this push towards sending your comments through email. Even if you're watching a video on YouTube, I'm much more likely to read your comment if you send it to me through email. The emails I get are so much more thoughtful than YouTube comments as well. I think that as well as just replacing, you know, social networks, we do need to think about how they can act within the interests of the communities that they serve and the end users. Facebook only think about that insofar as that it keeps people on their platform, but we need to think about that sincerely as to how our communities develop and grow and communicate. It's a slightly different perspective, and I don't think we should necessarily automatically assume that corporations do it right all the time. Sometimes it is beneficial for corporations to keep you ignorant and to keep you from learning about the technology that you're using so that you can't easily go elsewhere, so that they can make a quick buck off of you. Unfortunately, I think one of the more difficult parts of this overall challenge is educating people. A lot of people don't want to learn something new if they can't immediately see how it benefits them. And I think when we're talking about digital autonomy and digital freedom and breaking away from corporations, I think many people agree with us. But I also believe that they interpret these as abstract ideas that are somewhat, there is a degree of dissonance to act on them. And that can be difficult, taking something which is philosophical and ethical and then turning it into the tangible day-to-day uses. I don't think it's impossible, but I think that if we're going to truly gain autonomy and independence over our digital world, we're going to have to engage our brains and we're going to have to encourage other people to do the same. And that is also not going to be difficult. But let me know what you think. Email, Fediverse, it's all good. But I definitely admit that I think that email is, you know, it's been around forever. And a lot of people have been saying it's dead for forever, but it's not. If I email someone, even someone that doesn't regularly use email, they pick it up and respond. It's great. And I think Delta Chat can perhaps offer a new avenue to use email here. And maybe not. But it doesn't matter, because you're still using email, whether or not you're using Delta Chat, or whether or not you're using Mutt, or whether or not you're using K9, or Thunderbird, or Evolution, or a web client. It's all good. So this has been a bit of a ramble, just some thoughts on, you know, engaging on the social spaces and developing social spaces in a freedom-respecting, autonomous way, and or in a way that respects our autonomy, rather. And I think that it's one of the most important battles that we have to fight. And one of the reasons it's one of the most important battles is because it's one of those areas where corporations are so keen on controlling people and keeping people within an ecosystem that their communication and their relationships depend on. And that's not healthy. It's not healthy to be dependent on a corporation for your social life. That's something we should be crafting between ourselves. Yes, there will be businesses that aid in that, right? There is a phone company. There is a, you know, a landlord of the pub that you go and meet your friends at. That's always been the case. But what hasn't always been the case is that it has to be Facebook or no one. That the idea of closing a social media account is closing yourself off from the world. That is unhealthy. That's what we need to fight against. And that's why we have to win. So thank you for joining me. Please feel free to share your thoughts. I'm sure my ideas on this subject will develop, if not through the April cast, then certainly beyond that. It's something I'm always thinking about. It's something that I think is one of the areas where we need to do a lot better, but I think the technology is there, and I think that we just need to find better ways of engaging with people who are not technically minded. That doesn't always mean dumbing things down. Sometimes it does mean educating them. I think it has to mean educating them to a point. It also means making things fun. I know that sometimes we can take this very seriously because a lot of people who watch me are very seriously minded. You know, we look at the big problems of the world and we look at how to fix them. But we also have to think of ways to be more engaging and to beat the psychological warfare of the marketing departments of big tech, and that is a David and Goliath battle, if ever there was one. So thank you very much for joining me. Pleasure, as always. Let me know your thoughts, and until next time, I've been Chris Ware, and you've been awesome. Toodaloo.